The Obamas deliver a 1-2 punch, urging Americans to back Kamala Harris.
America's ready for a better story. We are ready for a President Kamala Harris.
Her story is your story. It's my story. It's the story of the vast majority of Americans.
Plus, Secretary Blinken ends his visit to the Middle East with no clear sign of a ceasefire deal.
We need to get the ceasefire and hostage agreement over the finish line, and we need to do it now.
And Kyiv puts pressure on the Russian church as Europe eyes Russian assets.
Today is Wednesday, August 21st, and this is VOA's Flashpoint. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish, alongside Lori London in Washington. Former President Barack Obama addressed Democrats in his home city of Chicago Tuesday night, saying Vice President Kamala Harris is the right choice to take on Donald Trump in the U.S. presidential election this November. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more from the second night of the Democratic National Convention.
A hometown welcome at the Democratic National Convention for former President Barack Obama.
America's ready for a new chapter. America's ready for a better story. We are ready for a President Kamala Harris.
Obama drew a direct comparison between Harris and her Republican opponent, former President Donald Trump.
Kamala Harris won't be focused on her problems. She'll be focused on yours. As president, she won't just cater to her own supporters and punish those who refuse to kiss the ring or bend the knee. She'll work on behalf of every American. That's who Kamala is.
Obama was introduced by his wife, Michelle, who said Harris's shortened campaign season should encourage Democrats to work even harder to elect her.
We cannot indulge our anxieties about whether this country will elect someone like Kamala instead of doing everything we can to get someone like Kamala elected.
Although Democrats already formalized their nomination process earlier this month, a ceremonial roll call of states.
Great state of Alabama proudly cast 56 votes for the first black woman president of the United States of America.
Showed the enthusiasm of Democrats for their new nominee.
All 34 of our votes for our next black woman and first South Asian president.
Harris thanked delegates remotely from her rally in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
So to everyone in Chicago and across America, thank you. Thank you.
Democrats also heard from Harris's husband, who called his wife a joyful warrior. Doug Emhoff is the second gentleman.
She'll lead from the belief that wherever we come from, whatever we look like, we're strongest when we fight for what we believe in, not just against what we fear.
The second night of the convention also featured former members of the Trump administration and Republican officials who have endorsed Harris. John Giles is the Republican mayor of Mesa, Arizona.
Trump made a lot of lofty promises. Unlimited economic growth, American manufacturing reborn, a secure border. Turns out Donald Trump was all talk.
On Wednesday, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz will address delegates here in Chicago, formally accepting the party's nomination as vice president. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago.
Meanwhile, outside the convention, multiple pro-Palestinian demonstrators were arrested Tuesday after clashing with police during a protest that began outside the Israeli consulate and spilled out into the surrounding streets.
In a related story, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken wrapped up his latest visit to the Middle East without a clear sign on whether a deal to end the fighting could be near.
We need to get the ceasefire and hostage agreement over the finish line, and we need to do it now. Time is of the essence.
After meetings in Israel, Egypt, and Qatar, Blinken said that Israel has accepted a proposal to bridge gaps with Hamas.
Over the coming days, we are going to do everything possible to, one, get Hamas on board with the bridging proposal, and then to make sure that both parties work on and agree to necessary details of implementation that would allow everything to go forward.
Few details have been released about the so-called bridging proposal, and despite the last-ditch diplomatic efforts, the conflict churned on as Israel jets hit about 30 targets throughout the Gaza Strip, including tunnels, launch sites, and an observation post.
And as the war in Gaza rages, Palestinian residents of a Jerusalem neighborhood have appealed to the Israeli Supreme Court, demanding they be given more water. The 120,000 residents of the area say they only get water 3 hours a week. VOA's Linda Gradstein reports from Kfar Aqab in East Jerusalem.
In the crowded East Jerusalem neighborhood of Kfar Aqab, Palestinians keep plastic tanks on their roofs to store water. Since water flows through the taps for just about 3 hours a week, residents like Nadia Iyad often have to buy water from private suppliers to fill their tanks at $50 each. This means she spends close to a quarter of her monthly salary buying water. She says that if she has the money, she buys water, and if not, she lives with no water, meaning she can't cook or shower. Kfar Aqab is a Palestinian neighborhood that Israel annexed to Jerusalem in 1967. But more than 20 years ago, Israel built a controversial barrier in and around the West Bank to stop suicide bombers. The wall left Kfar Aqab on the Palestinian side and separated it from the rest of Jerusalem. So although they pay Jerusalem city taxes, residents in Kfar Aqab receive few municipal services, including water. Imad Awad, the mayor of Kfar Aqab, says there are water shortages all over Palestinian areas of East Jerusalem and the West Bank. Even his municipality building is often without water.
And water, it's like basic, for a human, that's the minimum for the human to have his rights to have, nice life, water and food. It's the worst it's ever been in general for the whole country of Palestine, and specific Kfar Aqab because of the population.
A spokesman for the Israel Water Authority and its distributor, Mikarot, told VOA that according to previous agreements between Israel and the Palestinians, Kfar Aqab and other Palestinian areas in the West Bank should get their water from the Palestinian Water Authority, which in turn buys it from Mikarot. He said Mikarot is working to increase the water supply but needs to build more infrastructure. The Palestinian Water Authority and its subsidiary, Jerusalem Water Undertaking, say that as an East Jerusalem neighborhood, Kfar Aqab should get its water from the Jerusalem municipality. Palestinian activists say there has long been a pattern of discrimination in water supply throughout East Jerusalem and the West Bank. Jewish settlements get more water than they need, while Palestinian areas receive much less. They say the discrepancy has even increased since the beginning of the war against Hamas last October. Iyad Sunduka, a Palestinian community activist, says the surrounding Jewish settlements have water 24 hours a day, compared to the 3 hours a week in Kfar Aqab. Several Israeli human rights groups have appealed to the Israeli Supreme Court to get more water for Kfar Aqab. Even if they succeed, that will not solve the problem for Palestinians all over the West Bank. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Kfar Aqab.
Also in the Middle East, as millions of Shiite Muslims head to the Aberin pilgrimage in Iraq, a bus carrying pilgrims from Pakistan crashed and overturned in central Iran late Tuesday, killing 28 people. Authorities there say brakes on the bus failed.
The lack of progress toward a ceasefire has compounded the misery of Gazans struggling for space away from the fighting as the catastrophic humanitarian crisis continues to worsen. I spoke with emergency physician Dr. Javed Abdelmanam, who recently returned from Gaza after working as medical team lead with Doctors Without Borders at Nasser in Khan Yunis, one of the last functioning hospitals in southern Gaza. First, if you can just describe the situation for us on the ground.
There's overcrowding in the humanitarian zone with hundreds of thousands, million people squeezed into a very small area. And that includes where the hospital was in Khan Yunis. And you have this constant visuals, sound and sense of overt military action. So you can see the warships on the sea. You can see and hear the drones. And when the explosions occur, you can feel the shockwaves. It rattles your windows. It moves the curtains. So it's all very close and in your face. There's this endless stretch of makeshift dwellings, tents and shelters made out of wood or plastic or fabric, end to end in this humanitarian zone. Very, very cramped quarters. And in the hospital, which is supposed to be normally a 360-bed hospital, it's running over capacity, particularly as other hospitals, especially in Rafah, at the beginning of July, were forced to close. And so you're working in an environment that's crowded and you're receiving mass casualties of civilians who live in a so-called safe zone, a humanitarian zone. And all that is in the context of having supplies that are erratic and not dependable. So it's a very, very pressured and tense environment. And you feel the lack of safety in front of you.
Did you feel that you were able to appropriately treat the patients that came in?
You can and you cannot. So during a mass casualty, which by definition will exceed the capacity of the ER and the hospital at that moment, the triage and management algorithm changes and more people will die than normally. If you receive 5 injured in a 5-bed resus, you can manage it. But if you receive 60 or 189 or 265 at once, of course, you're not going to be able to do all that you want to do for each and every patient. But outside of that, it's the supplies. So we have to change our treatment regimens. We have to use alternatives. And one example is that when dressings were running very low, and we as MSF run a trauma and orthopedics and burns unit inside Nasser, over 60 beds, we had to change the frequency of dressings changes for our burns patients to conserve the dressings that we did have so that they wouldn't rupture. And that meant people were having the dressings on for longer, 3 to 4 days, as opposed to 2 to 3 days. And when you run out of simple painkillers like ibuprofen or examination gloves or surgical gowns, it really changes what you have to do each day.
What sorts of injuries and illnesses were you witnessing? We're obviously hearing a lot of concern about polio now, other infectious diseases, given the lack of sanitation.
In the top 5 diagnoses in our primary healthcare centers and medical points that we run as MSF, several of them across all parts of the humanitarian zone, and actually one up in Gaza City as well, they're all water and sanitation related and or infectious. So we have chest infections, diarrheal infections, scabies infestation, skin infections and eye infections. And those are all water and sanitation related and show you and prove that the water services, clean water, sanitation, the presence of latrines, soap are not present in enough quantities to avoid these avoidable diseases. In the hospital in which I worked in Nasser, by definition, because we run a trauma unit and burns, I was seeing a lot of these. So mass casualties, explosive injuries, children, women, men, civilians, healthcare workers with traumatically amputated limbs, with extensive burns to 20, 30, 40, 50, 60% of their total body surface area. Multiple limbs injured, broken bones, degloving injuries where you lose all the soft tissue to your limbs during an explosion. So really quite large injuries. And then through all of that, we mustn't forget, must we? And I don't, to not forget the mental ill health, the distress, the stress, the terror, the fear and despair caused by serial displacements, instability, and a lack of safety. So that's running through everything on everybody.
Emergency physician Javed Abdelmanam, just back from leading a medical team with Doctors Without Borders in Gaza.
You're listening to Flashpoint from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish with Lori London here in Washington. Time now to turn our attention to Europe and Russia's invasion of Ukraine. We'll take a look at how some European countries are trying to support Kyiv by using the proceeds from frozen Russian assets in a moment. First, though, we go to Kyiv and our correspondent Anna Chernikova with news about a new push to curtail the influence of the Russian Church in Ukraine.
The Ukrainian operation in Russia's Kursk region continues. The Ukrainian military reported that Russian forces are trying to prevent the further advance of the Ukrainian defense forces by bringing in troops from other areas. That's Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. He said that Ukraine continues to achieve its goals and is not planning to stop. The Ukrainian public generally perceives the operation in the Kursk region positively. For many, this is the only way to get Russia to the negotiating table, as this demonstrates that the war is actually happening on both sides. Additionally, it is a much-needed boost in morale. Olha lives in Kyiv. She says that while she doesn't know what the result of entering Kursk will be, she appreciates the soldiers' courage and the increase in optimism. Yaroslav, also a Kyiv resident, is a little more cautious. He worries that Ukraine is taking its side off a reclaiming territory in Donbas, which he believes is a higher priority than going into Kursk. Inside Ukraine, Russian forces keep the pressure high near Pokrovsk and conduct more massive missile and drone attacks. In the early hours of Wednesday, Russian forces launched another massive airstrike across Ukraine with ballistic and cruise missiles, as well as 69 drones. Meanwhile, the Ukrainian parliament voted on a bill that will end the operation of Russia-affiliated religious organizations in Ukraine. This is mainly directed towards the Russian Orthodox Church branch that for a very long time was represented in Ukraine through the so-called Ukrainian Church of Moscow Patriarchate. The priests and leadership of the church were often accused of supporting the Russia and promoting Russian propaganda narratives and cooperating with Russian officials. President Zelensky called it an important step forward for Ukrainian spiritual independence. The new bill provides such organizations with 9 months to prove their independence from Russia. If failed, they will be banned on the territory of Ukraine. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
Elsewhere in Europe, Germany and other G7 countries are developing ways to support Ukraine through loans financed with the proceeds of frozen Russian assets. The German finance ministry announced the effort on Tuesday. Latvia, once a sanctuary for Russian money, is a strong backer of the plan. VOA's Miroslava Gungadze reports from Riga.
Jūrmala, near the Latvian capital of Riga, used to be a top vacation spot for affluent Soviet citizens up to 1991, when the Soviet Union collapsed. Then, as a new member of the European Union, Latvia offered a golden visa and a residency permit to those who opened a bank account and invested in real estate. It became a key EU entry point for wealthy Russians, says Sanita Jamberga, with the Baltic Center for Investigative Journalism.
People in Soviet Union used to come here, which was nostalgia, the window to the Europe, etc. And when we started to sell off properties and banks, then this is a street where you would meet every Russian oligarch you want to imagine who had a property here.
As an investigative journalist, Jamberga follows Russian money in Latvia. She says over the last two decades, Russians have created a beachfront sanctuary in Jūrmala.
It's a little Russia without Putin, let's put it this way.
She says Latvian law at the time allowed for the easy flow of Russian money in and out of the country. The scheme continued even after Russian invasion of Crimea in 2014. Paulis Lienkovs is the Latvia's top financial investigator.
Up until 2018, Latvia was indeed considered to be a money laundering haven.
But Ilyenkov says things changed in 2018 after a report by the European Commission accused Latvia of not doing enough to fight money laundering. That US also accused the Latvian bank of institutionalized money laundering and sanctions circumvention.
There was a very strong political commitment to very swiftly reform our financial system. And that was indeed done in a very short time frame. There was a lot of changes in the legislative framework. There was a lot of resources granted to the competent authorities to fight financial crime.
Latvia also reformed its financial sector, creating Latvia's Financial Intelligence Unit, which tackles money laundering and enforces EU and US sanctions related to Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
We have published a list of every person whose funds have been frozen in Latvia based on sanctions, and not just directly designated individuals who are on the sanctions list, but also legal persons who are owned or controlled by sanctioned individuals.
157 individuals and accounts have been sanctioned in Latvia, totaling about $110 million have been frozen, says Lienkovs. The frozen assets include 74 real estate properties, including one in Jurmala, owned by Mikhail Friedman, a Ukrainian-born Russian-Israeli tycoon.
This used to be a sanatorium, which was bought by Mikhail Friedman's company, and they wanted to make it into probably hotel and apartment place because he is just 200 meters.
Earlier this summer, the foreign ministers of the three Baltic states, including Latvia, argued the G7 to work toward using frozen Russian assets for Ukraine's benefit. Miroslava Gungadze, VOA News, Riga, Latvia.
As European countries are working together to help Ukraine, Russia and China are strengthening their friendship as well. On Wednesday, Russian Prime Minister Mikhail Mishustin met with Chinese Premier Li Keqiang in Moscow. Mishustin and Li are expected to discuss bilateral relations and exchange views on cooperation between the two countries. Li is expected to meet President Vladimir Putin at the Kremlin later on Wednesday. He heads to Belarus on Friday. In India, members of the LGBT community showed solidarity with protesting doctors in Kolkata on Tuesday night. Carrying torches, they marched, demanding justice for a 31-year-old student doctor who was murdered and raped inside her college on August 9th.
So we have seen that in government spaces where the citizens should be get utmost protection, they are being molested, they are being raped heinously. So we, the civil citizens of our country, are feeling unprotected, insecure, and it's almost a death of democracy.
That was rights activist Anurag Maitri. India's top court on Tuesday constituted a national task force to recommend provisions for improving the security and safety of medical professionals. The public anger and protests over the violence against women is reminiscent of what followed the brutal gang rape and murder of a 23-year-old student on a bus in New Delhi in 2012.
And finally today, more on Mpox. Argentine authorities have quarantined a cargo ship over a suspected case of Mpox on board. That, according to the government Tuesday, the Liberian-flagged ship was sailing from Santos, Brazil, also a major commodities hub, on its way to pick up soy cargo.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of Lori London and the rest of our team here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.